Hey everyone, this is Brian Hertel. I edit the CoinWorld podcast and I'm here to let you know about another fun and free product we offer through CoinWorld, our email newsletters. With our newsletters, you could pick from 10 options like US coins, world coins, or paper money to tailor the high quality content you receive. Pick the topics that interest you most, or choose them all and get the latest from CoinWorld delivered straight to your inbox. Signing up is free and easy to do. I've put a link in the show notes for you, so just click there, choose your content, and your email newsletters will be on the way shortly. Click on that link today and enjoy the show.
Welcome to the CoinWorld Podcast. Here are your hosts, Chris Bullfinch and Jeff Stark.
Welcome to the CoinWorld Podcast. I'm Chris Bullfinch.
And I am Jeff Stark.
This week's episode is all about you, the listeners. We're dealing with some listener questions that we didn't cover a couple of weeks ago when we were answering some questions from a listener who had written us a list of questions. And our discussion centers on another listener's interest in wooden nickels. We also have our usual bevy of numismatic features.
And this is the programming note where we remind you to share the podcast with your friends, neighbors, enemies, and so forth. This is the plug that we do every week. So general reminder, please do that so we can keep showing up here again and again and sharing our love for the hobby with everyone out there. So you're talking about a listener interest of wooden nickels. Many people have heard the phrase, don't take a wooden nickel, but collectors of wooden nickels, ligdenerist or something, it's a very tongue-twisty word, they not only take wooden nickels, they actively seek them out. What is the impetus for this as our discussion this week, Chris?
Yeah, so about week and a half, almost 2 weeks ago, we received an email from Southern Coin. That's the screen name of the email account that reached out to us. And the email reads, I am a listener of the podcast, and one thing that I like to collect is wooden nickels. I was wondering if you and Jeff could do an episode on them. I think it would be interesting to hear your opinions on them, and if there is someone who's an expert on them, if they could be interviewed and maybe spread some information on wooden nickels. Thanks, Joshua. So this piqued my interest because I enjoy wooden nickels. I find them interesting. And there's something that I find a lot of non-collectors tend to know about because of the popularity of the phrase, don't take any wooden nickels. Jeff, you kind of referenced that just a minute ago. And so I think that that phrase can offer sort of an entry point for people who might not know a lot about numismatics or exonumia to engage with this kind of group of collectibles. And also, they just tend to be really affordable. I mean, I see pretty frequently in auction groups that, Jeff, you and I are a part of, I see big lots of wooden nickels coming up fairly regularly. And especially for pieces that were made by organizations in different parts of the country, that can have a sort of an intrinsic appeal for people as well. You know, I know that, for example, when I was living in Ohio and you and I would go to the Shelby County Coin Club meetings, Jeff, I know that, you know, I got a couple of wooden nickels that the club had produced. And I think you were involved in their production, and I'll let you elaborate on that in a second. You know, I found those interesting because they're sort of a little token of my time spent in Ohio. I'd like the Shelby County Coin Club, and it was cool to have a little memento of my local club. And that same local appeal can go to in all kinds of different directions. And so I think that that combined with the sort of, I don't want to say pop culture familiarity because they're not really a part of pop culture, but they're more a part of quote unquote mainstream culture than a lot of other numismatic or exonumic items. And so I think that that appeal can make them a really good entree into the hobby. And plus they go back quite a ways. We'll discuss their historical origins at greater length in a minute, but you know, they arise out of a really interesting sort of socioeconomic context in, you know, coming out of the Great Depression. So I find them really, really interesting. I'm not an expert in them. I don't specialize in wooden nickels, that they're not my specialty, but I do find them really interesting. And again, because of their affordability and their relative ubiquity, I think that they can be a valuable way for people on especially people on a budget to get more involved with the hobby and to, you know, they just make for really interesting little curios.
It is rare that I visit a flea market or antique shop and don't chance upon several examples of wooden nickels. Such is their ubiquity. You know, as you mentioned, referenced, they did really gain the traction in the United States during the Great Depression, and soon thereafter went from being rectangular to being round. I've picked up dozens, maybe even hundreds of examples, certainly dozens of the flat ones, but hundreds of examples overall, many from here in Ohio, where I've spent almost 17 years, or from my home state of Missouri. Most of the Missouri ones are round. It's interesting, you know, most wooden nickels today are like 33 millimeters, somewhere around that size. Maybe I'm off a millimeter or two. For comparison, about the size of a Kennedy half dollar. So, you know, that doesn't go hand in hand with the size of a 5 cent coin in the US, but you need the larger landscape or canvas to depict the design. And usually you see a Native American design reminiscent of, or buffalo bison design reminiscent of the quote-unquote buffalo nickels from 1913 to 1938. Sometimes you'll, less frequently, you'll see like an American flag or some other emblem like that. Usually it's one of those two as a design element for one side, and then the other side will have the advertising or the message side. You are correct. I did help the Shelby County Coin Club. Back in 2011, the club celebrated its 50th anniversary. Club is gearing up for 60th anniversary next year. Many of the folks who helped found the club actually in 1961 were on staff at CoinWorld at the time, because CoinWorld started in 1960 and they realized, hey, there's, you know, we have this collection of numismatic minds here in Shelby County, you know, let's get together and share the love of the hobby. So there's actually a company in Texas that I coordinated with. You know, we had, you know, Mark, one of his daughters created the design, and, you know, I reached out to the place that makes the wooden nickels and said, you know, we want to have the couple different colors on there and, you know, ink. And you know, it was a real neat project to do, you know, 1,000 wooden nickels or something for a couple hundred bucks, and maybe 2,000, I don't remember. But, you know, we give them away to folks who come to the show, which had been annual this year. Of course, we didn't do a show, but they'll get back to it, I believe, next year, next May. Especially young collectors, any young collector who would come to the show would generally receive one. It's just a neat way to promote the club and celebrate that, you know, hey, this was a milestone. They are pieces of history, especially, you know, many today, I think most uses of wooden nickels are for club and collector related means. Whereas, you know, my Missouri wooden nickel collection has just an abundance of places that use them as advertising, as, you know, something for a, you know, like a reward, you know, you like a free ice cream cone or whatever, you know, 25 cents off your purchase or that sort of thing. Certainly the rectangular pieces, I know you picked one up when we were out junking. The rectangular pieces are really neat because it's sort of like, it's like, oh, it's wooden money, but it's not, is it a nickel? Is it a, it's not this idea of a coin, because, you know, so many coins around, although of course we know that that isn't a requirement for being a coin. And there are many coins that are octagonal and four, you know, just many different sides, different shapes. But a lot of towns issued these in commemoration. You've been to Greenville, Ohio, which is in Dark County, and Dark County issued multiple wooden nickels for one of its anniversaries, and including sizes that were like 50 millimeter. I mean, like giant wooden nickels. I've even seen, you know, so it's wooden nickel, but I've seen different denominations called a dickel and a trickle, maybe. I think the dickel is 7.5 cents, not 5 cents. But anyway, you know, it's just a really fun, neat area of the hobby. And again, certainly affordable. It's something that you can find at most shows. Certainly folks who focus on tokens and metals, you know, you'll often see them in root bins. You know, you can root through here four for a dollar, two for a dollar, sometimes a dollar a piece type item. It's a great way to get started and to have an appreciation for some place that you lived or live or want to go or whatever. It's just a neat little time capsule into what businesses and people were doing and celebrating in that given time frame.
Yeah, and I appreciate you making reference to our junking trip in Van Wert, Ohio, actually. We were driving through Van Wert on our way to the ANA show back in the summer of 2019, which feels like it was about an eon ago.
But, yes. yes, it does.
And I bought a handful of rectangular wooden nickels that were issued. I can't remember exactly what event they were issued for, but there was some kind of an event in Van Wert in, I believe, I'd have to go look at them. They're filed away in my collection, but I think they were issued in 1951, and I thought they were really cool. Their designs weren't particularly appealing in the sense that it was mostly just text on a thin rectangular piece of wood, but I found them really interesting, and I figured, you know, I might not make it back to this little antique shop in Van Wert, Ohio, and might as well have a keepsake of it. And you mentioned the role of wooden nickels in advertising, and that's what they're so often used for. They're usually advertising pieces. And I think that that suggests a potential collecting strategy, which is that if there's a group of wooden nickels from an industry that you're interested in exploring, or I mentioned this at the towards the beginning of this segment, if you're interested in collecting wooden nickels from a particular place, you know, you could put together quite a set. And wooden nickels have been issued, like we said, you know, they date back to the Great Depression. So you can find some really early pieces that are from either a place you're interested in, you know, from an industry or an organization that you have some kind of a connection to. They're really wonderful and they're a lot of fun. And especially like we've mentioned, for collectors that are on a bit of a budget, they can make for a really cool exonumic addition to any number of collections. And even if you really like Buffalo Nickels and you're taken with James Earl Frazier's classic design, then, you know, you can buy a wooden nickel that has designs that evoke that coin. So, you know, there are any number of different ways to collect them. If I see any individual pieces or a large collection for the right price, I would absolutely consider picking them up for my own collection. So, yeah, no, I think they're really, really cool pieces.
Yeah, I tried to convince a friend of mine here locally who owns a funeral home when the funeral home had its 150th anniversary a few years ago. I said, well, why don't you do like an elongated sand or wooden nickel or, you know, I didn't expect him to do a metal, but, you know, that would have been neat, a wooden nickel or something that they could have done. He didn't end up doing it, but that would have been cool. I could have collected wooden nickels from funeral homes and parlors.
That's a little sort of a morbid collection, but definitely yes. Cool. Yeah. Well, and also, you know, and even outside of numismatics, I think any number of small businesses, if they really wanted to advertise in kind of an eye-catching, distinctive way, they might consider making wooden nickels. It's very inexpensive. You're basically just buying wood, ink, and printing costs. And they're inexpensive to make. And if, you know, they're being handed out in some small town somewhere, someone might look down and go, oh, wow, that's really cool. You know, I'll go and check this business out, especially if it was like, you know, a dollar off, you know, a dollar off a burger or something at some new restaurant. You know, it's funny, you mentioned Greenville, Ohio, that made me think of Made Right sandwiches, which you were kind enough to introduce me to, Jeff. And, you know, and so I think that even outside of numismatics, they might make for really effective sort of advertising pieces as well. So, you know, for anyone who stumbles upon this podcast, who might not be a collector, but who wants to open a small business, that is an advertising strategy that you might consider.
Absolutely.
Anyway. So this has been a fun little foray into wooden nickels, and actually I would love at some point to take Southern Coins / Joshua's suggestion and have on a wooden nickel expert. There are companies that make them, and there are people who collect them and have written about them, and I would love to speak to one or more wooden nickel experts at some point in the future.
There are two different American organizations, shall I say, dedicated to collecting wooden nickels. There's the Dedicated Wooden Money Collectors and the International Order of Wooden Money Collectors. So and they're based in the U.S. So it's a ripe field for the harvest, as it were.
Yeah, absolutely. So now that we've delved into the history of wooden nickels, the history and collectability of wooden nickels a little bit, Jeff, what was happening this week in numismatic history more broadly? Wooden nickels are sort of a niche exonumic interest. What was happening in numismatic history this week, Jeff?
So it's funny you mentioned Frazier because he, you know, of course, is well known as the designer of the nickel, the 1913 to 1938 nickel, he had a famous artistic wife, and she was in the news this date, October 27th, 1931. Laura Garden Fraser won a second design competition for the Washington Quarter Dollar. Of course, we know that would follow a year later in 1932, or in this case, mere months later than October 27th, 1931. It would debut in 1932. However, it would not include her design. Her design won two different compositions, but was not chosen. And that is, I think, for shame, because it was a great design. I believe there are privately struck pieces with the design. Was it used, revived for the commemorative?
Yeah, her proposed design, or at least elements of, I think it might have been the entire design, but there could have just been elements from her design, were used on a gold commemorative coin in 1999.
There you go. Yeah, I knew that was 200 years after his death. I remembered as I was talking, wait a minute. Some of you may have seen it because of this. So that's the big news of broad numismatic impact, because, you know, that's a coin that we see in our pockets today, all that. Interestingly, on October 28th, 1978, was the Indiana, Kentucky, Ohio Token and Metal Society first show in Vandalia, Ohio. So ICOTAMS, as the organization is short changed to, has an annual show. And interestingly, it was just this past weekend, and I went to it, and the show was a few miles from Vandalia. It was in Englewood. And it was very interesting because, you know, it's been several years since I've attended the show. I don't know why I fell out of going to it, because I used to go with the late Eric von Klinger, who was a Coin World staffer for 10 years or so until sometime in 2008. And Eric and I would go to the show. In fact, that was the show at the time was in Wapakoneta, Ohio, which is home to the Neil Armstrong Museum.
A very cool museum I've been.
Yeah. Yeah. And so Eric and I would go up there. The ICOTAM show was Saturday. The Tri-County Coin Club coin show would have their full-on coin show the next day at the same venue, the fairgrounds. But they moved the show. ICOTAM's moved the show several years ago down to Englewood. And I just had gotten out of going, but I decided to go this time. Certainly, this was a weird year and all that, but I wanted to see, you know, it's been a while, and I know some of the dealers that set up there, and, you know, I'm always looking to add stuff to my collection. And frankly, for that matter, as we record this podcast, I've spent the good majority of my free time today organizing my collection, trying to wrap my head around what exactly I have, which I think the short answer is too much. But anyway, it was just interesting that, you know, here it was. ICOTAM's first show was 42 years ago, just down the road from us, just down the road from Coin World's home. It actually allowed me to stop at a coin shop there in Vandalia that they moved all of like two doors down and expanded, and really, so I don't know if you were ever at Crossroads, but I hadn't been. They just moved to their new site a couple weeks ago, Andy said. As I'm wont to do, I rifled through the World Coin bin and found a neat assortment of coins. I didn't tell you this, Chris, but I got a bunch of the 1967 Russian anniversary coins, multiple denominations. It's like somebody, somebody busted up a set or the sets of them and just dumped them in there. So that was fun. It's always fun to find $2, $3, $4, $5 coins for a song, and I'll put them in 2x2s and continue alphabetizing and organizing my my pile. So yeah, that was what was happening this week in numismatic history. For those who care to be tuned into that sort of thing.
It's funny that you know, we're talking about going to antique shows, antique shops and coin shows and different venues to expand our own collections. You know, I'd love to talk at some point in a future episode. I don't think we really have time to delve into it in as much detail as it merits now, but I would be really interested in talking to you about the inspiration that you get. I know that it's the same thing happens with me. I know that you and I both find inspiration at these shows for things that we want to write about. If we find or buy something that's really cool, or if we see something that really piques our interest, you know, I know that you do this, and I know that I try to sort of make a mental note of something really interesting that I see. If I happen to know about it, it might just inspire me. Oh, I'd love to write an article about that if I already know a little bit about it. But if it's something that's really kind of out there or something I haven't seen before, sometimes I'll make a mental note, like, just research this. And maybe in the process of researching it, you know, you might sort of find an article in that research process. You know, you might be able to turn it into an article. So, you know, you saying that has made me think of that and hearing about the new additions to your collection. You and I talk about new acquisitions all the time. But speaking of the sort of the writing process and sort of how it is that you and I actually know each other, what was happening in coin world history this week?
So, all right, we're going to go back to 1967. That was one of the choices given to us by just the random number generator. So we go to the October 25, 1967 issue. I found this fascinating front page coverage headlined Bronx Men Guilty on All Counts in 1964 Multi-Struck Scent Trial. The two men were sentenced November 21st. The headline tells us that they were to be sentenced that day. Two Bronx men, William Steiner and Victor C. Piacentelli, I think, have been found guilty of mail and wire fraud, possession and sale of fraudulently altered 1964 cents, and conspiracy. Gosh, these guys, it turns out they faced trial and were convicted in the U.S. District Court, Southern District of New York, for taking genuine 1964 cents and altering them and then ripping people off, selling them, advertising them through the New York Times and other places. There were 15 government witnesses compared to 6 defense witnesses, all sorts of exhibits, photographs, slides, movies of the coin minting process. It was 39 counts alleged that both defendants conspired to commit the violations, as we read. I mean, it's just amazing that they thought they could get away with this, and they advertised it in the New York Times. Okay, you know, nobody's ever said that criminals are the smartest people. That, to me, was sort of like, really? You know, people saw that and went, wait a minute, these aren't legitimate mint errors. What's the deal? This is, you know, they were selling these coins, altered coins, for more than $25 each. Now, think about this. 1960, it was 64 cents. So I don't know exactly the time frame, but sometime between 1964 and 1967, I would venture to guess that the wheels of justice, like now, were slow then. So say they were 1965 cents. 1965, $25 in 1965. Well, you could find a dollar in circulation in 1965 that was silver, right? So yeah. If we took 25 of those dollars to get $25 as the sale price of these quote-unquote mint errors, what would that look like in today numbers? Well, the dealer I visited on Saturday had a buy price of 15 times face and a sell price of like 18 times face for silver American coinage by the dollar. So $25 times 15 is $375, if my rough math is accurate, times 18, you're talking $450. So somewhere between $375 and $450 is what $25 in 1965 was today. If you use that as a sort of economic barometer, I know that there are other ways you can check this. You can, you know, I don't think the five cent Coke wasn't still around then. Maybe it was a 10 cent Coke and you go, gosh, I go to a McDonald's today and get a dollar soda here in Ohio, any size. So 10 times and then, okay, you know, I mean, $25 would have been 250 sodas. And it's a dollar now, so that's $250. I don't know. There's a lot of numbers here. We don't want to confuse you. But $25 in mid-60s was, you know, maybe $400 today, $300, $400. That's a lot of money. But the guys didn't get away with it. They got busted and they were sentenced. So that was very interesting. And there's another headline on the page that says mint expert testimony was an important trial factor. So, you know, when you advertise in the New York Times, you're not going to get away with it. And these guys certainly didn't. So that was why this issue really jumped out. It's just, you know, here we are. That was 67. We're talking 53 years later, and we're still dealing with counterfeits, fakes, all these things. Now it's coming from Wish and Alibaba and some of these other places. But the fact remains, they're still out there, and you still have to know what you're dealing with and educate yourself, because these things do exist and pitfalls are out there for the unsuspecting and maybe untrained buyer.
It doesn't seem very prudent for a forger to advertise in a major national newspaper. You know, it's funny, that made me think in Numismatic Forgery, a book that I talked about on the podcast a couple weeks ago, Charles Larson describes a number of strategies by which forgers could get their product into the market. And most of those methods rely on dispersing your product over a wide area and not calling attention to yourself. So it doesn't seem like those people were heeding that basic rule of thumb.
Yeah, let me put out take out a billboard that says fake potential fake coins here. No,
seriously, it is strange that they would have called attention to themselves in that way.
Something on the letters page, I'm sure, spoke to you, though.
Yeah, so there was one short letter that jumped out at me this week, and it jumped out at me for two reasons. But first, I'll read the letter, and then I'll elaborate on my reasons for picking it. And it reads, "Just returned from a trip to Centennial Numismatic Park at Sudbury, Ontario, Canada. The Big Nickel is indeed a worthwhile exhibit which all collectors of coins and metal should visit. Ted Silva, who instigated the development of this park, is to be complimented for its creation. This letter was written by Thomas W. Bennett from Terre Haute, Indiana." And I picked it for two reasons. The first is that the fact that it talks about the Big Nickel in Ontario, we were talking about wooden nickels, so I thought talking about a Canadian nickel to complement our discussion of wooden nickels, which are largely a U.S. phenomenon. Although I would have to imagine that some version of wooden nickels were produced up in Canada, though I can't speak on that with any authority.
And we know that there were similar items in Austria, you know, in the 20s. So, I mean, the origins really are, you know, as we've mentioned, Great Depression here in the U.S., but there's some similarities elsewhere, earlier pieces, and they certainly have been used elsewhere.
Wooden coins, tokens, and medals, though mostly tokens and medals, are not unheard of in other countries as well. So, but again, I thought that, you know, reference to a Canadian nickel, I thought that it's sort of thematically connected to the wooden nickels that we were talking about. And also, I had heard of the Big Nickel before. I think, Jeff, I'm not sure if we've ever mentioned it on the podcast before, but it's this 9 meter tall...
Oh, come on. Speak American.
I don't know how to convert without Google and like a Google calculator. I don't know how to convert meters into feet. I learned it in high school because they taught us the conversion ratios for all from English to metric measurements, or English to metric units, I should say. And honestly, I just don't remember. But it's this huge monument in Sudbury in Ontario, and it was put up in the mid-1960s, not too long before this magazine or before this edition of CoinWorld was published. I believe I read on the website for a Canadian museum, I read that the thing was put up in 1964, and the nickel that it depicts is actually sort of an interesting Canadian coin. It was struck in 1951 in honor of the 200th anniversary of the discovery of nickel. And this circulating commemorative 5-cent piece was struck and issued in 1951, and it depicts a nickel refinery along with some maple leaves around it, which obviously are a very common motif on Canadian coins. And then it has the date 1751 and 1951. And so in the mid-1960s, I gather, they wanted to put this up as a nod to Sudbury's mining history. Apparently, Sudbury up in Canada, in Ontario, Canada, has something of a mining history, and they wanted to put this this giant model of a nickel up to sort of pay homage to that, or to,
yes,
to sort of acknowledge that. And so I found that interesting not only because it was a nickel and it connected to the wooden nickels, and I just found the fact that they created a giant 9 meter monument to a nickel, I just found that really interesting. But it also, it made me think of something that you and I have talked about, Jeff, mostly off of the podcast. It's possible we've made reference to it in previous episodes. But Jeff, you've talked a lot about doing a numismatic travelogue, about going to sort of numismatically relevant sites or sites that have some connection to numismatic history or that are just interesting historic sites about which maybe a commemorative coin was made or a commemorative coin was dedicated to a particular, you know, a particular landmark. We talked about the Burnside Bridge on the reverse of the Antietam, a commemorative half dollar, for example. Yeah. And, you know, Jeff, you've talked about doing sort of a numismatic travelogue where you go to these places and you document the connection between numismatic history and this place. And I think that's a really awesome idea. And it kind of seems like Mr. Bennett of Terre Haute, Indiana, was kind of doing a version of that by sending this letter into CoinWorld back in 1967.
Yeah, so you're talking like 29 and a half feet for that 9-meter object.
And thank you for looking into it.
my first inclination was, okay, it's 3 feet plus per meter, so it's somewhere between 27 and 30 feet, and it's 29 and a half, so that's like almost square in the middle.
I knew it was somewhere in that range, but I didn't want to do it in my head, and I didn't want to give a specific number and then certainly be wrong.
So, you know, you mentioned the 1951 Canadian 5-cent coin, which, you know, celebrates nickel. I buy and search through a lot of Canadian money as I basically I'm just stockpiling nickel and copper and, you know, just that coin is the toughest to find out there, you know, that is noticeably different. You know, during the war, they had the V design, right? And of course, in 1967, they had the centennial design and whatever, but that 1951 nickel is the rarest one that I've found of a special design. I've gone through $1,000 Canadian, maybe nickels, and only found a couple dozen. I mean, it's tough to find. So they're a neat little coin. You can buy them a couple bucks a piece, but it is nice. And then the big nickel, there are multiple medals that show the big nickel. And as I recall, the coin shop that I visited over this last weekend, 10 years ago, maybe back when they still had a lot of tokens and medals, you know, usually they have a little bin with world coins, and then they had a similar one with tokens and medals for you to paw through. And I was there with my late friend Eric, and I found, I don't know, 3 or 5 or 8 of those Sudbury big nickel medals. And so they're here somewhere in my collection, and they're just neat, you know, and I think they couple different medals. One was like a white metal, one's a copper or brass. And, you know, it's just a neat little piece. That's like, how meta is this? It's a numismatic item celebrating a statue celebrating or a monument celebrating a numismatic item, you know.
Numismatically meta. That would be a great name for a numismatic show or podcast. Yeah. Yeah, no, that's really cool. I only have one or two of the 1951 Canadian nickels, and I actually think the design is kind of cool, and I find the history of them really interesting and appealing as well. So, no, they're cool coins, and the big nickel is a fascinating numismatic landmark. So, we've spent some time reading this old edition of CoinWorld from 1967, but Jeff, you recently acquired an interesting book that you wanted to talk about. What have you been reading?
Yeah, so Chris and I do this every other week. You know, 1 week he talks about something he's reading, looking at, using in his research, and then the next week it's me. I think I mentioned on here before that there's a guy in, I think it's North Carolina, that I'm connected to him through some ephemera groups on Facebook. And whenever he gets numismatic books, he asked me first. And a lot of times, I mean, I've come up with some good stuff thanks to him that I didn't have before. Like I got R.W. Julian's Medals of the United States Mint the First Century back in 2019. I also got the book on the Getz Medals by Günther Kienast. Those are both tough, rare, and in the case of Kienast, really expensive books. And this guy has been super great in that regard. And that was the guy that I got the Chinese book that I referenced a couple weeks ago. So he messages me and says, hey, I got this book that seems right up your alley. It looks really neat. And I'd never heard of it. And I go, okay, well, I like the guy and I don't want to lose the lifeline. I don't want him to like, oh, well, this guy's not buying the stuff. And I'd never heard of it. And I thought, okay, you know, it's $15 and $3.50 postage. And I'm not going to be, you know, I'm out $20 if I don't, I don't know, is it really worth it? Are there other books that have this information? And I think, well, you know, probably so, because I think this book was published like, you know, 1970 something or 86, it turns out. But, you know, a long time ago, substantially anyway. The book is titled United States National Banknotes and Their Seals by DeWitt G. Prather. And I never heard of this guy. Now, I'm no expert in any one area. I just know a little bit about a little bit, you know, and I know where to go to find the information. That's why I have an enormous library so that, hey, you know, when I don't know something, I go look. And he sends me a couple images inside and I go, I don't know. I was real iffy about this. So the book arrived here a couple days ago. And as soon as I picked it up, I was really intrigued by some of the things. It's really a nice little presentation. It shows banknotes by state, and they're in order of accession to the Union, and it shows different denominations and some of what the design implements look like. And it just talks about what notes were issued and signatures and this and that. Like I say, a lot of information that you can get elsewhere, none that really have this presentation state by state visually. I found that was helpful. But then what I really found interesting is this chapter 4, personal notes and stories. He goes through, and his collecting journey really began in 1953. So you're talking 1986. So that was 3 years before, and he's name dropping Ammon Carter. He talks about being at the 1970 St. Louis A&A. Really interesting stuff. Stories about people that he's met with in the hobby. One of which was really funny, not paper money related, oddly, but at the time he was 1953, he was living in Waynesboro, Pennsylvania, and also living there was a veterinary doctor that wanted to attend the A&A show with him in Cleveland. And so they carpooled, and this is Doc is how he refers to this. Doc, in his profession, plied his trade at a lot of farms around Waynesboro. He would go into the farmhouses and sniff out the good ladies' antiques. Being a pretty good horse trader, he had a 3-story brick home on the edge of town in which he and his wife carried on an antique business as a sideline. This rascal knew that I had 3 early gold eagles, the 1795, the 1799, and the 1801, for which I had paid a total of some $265. Doc pleaded with me to sell him my 3 eagles. Before we reached home, this is on their way back from the A&A, I reluctantly sold him my gold pieces for $300. I sure hate for someone to beg from me. Needless to say, I'm still kicking myself every time I think about it. God rest Doc's soul. The value in this is you get to meet a guy who apparently he was a bigger deal than I realized in paper money collecting. You get to meet a guy who had, I mean, anybody who uses their collection as the basis of a book has to be a pretty serious hobbyist. And one of the stories really interesting, the Winnemucca story. In August 1970, he and his wife went to the A&A St. Louis Convention. He went principally to buy a Winnemucca note. Now, if you've ever driven across country on US 40, now I-80, or the old route before that, chances are that you drove through or gassed up without even noticing the town name, Winnemucca, Nevada, named for an Indian chief. He goes on to tell the story of how rare this note was, how he really got caught up in bidding. He really wanted this note, lost out. There's some big names were involved in it. So it's just, it's one of these books that I'm glad I bought it. You know, I'm a fervent supporter in buying numismatic literature and taking for what you can learn from them out of it and benefiting your hobby journey. As it turns out, it's signed on the inside from the author, which, okay, it's neat. You know, this guy who wrote this book had the book in his hand and signed it. But, you know, it's a nice little snapshot into an area of the hobby that I venture to guess there probably aren't that many written records like this of these personal stories. So, you know, for my money for $18.50, I'm glad I bought it. There's some things that are maybe helpful if I need to write about this stuff, but it's certainly just from an awareness and an educational standpoint, fun to see. And that's what was on my bookshelf this week.
Oh, that's awesome. Thank you so much for sharing. It sounds like a fascinating volume. I would love to give it a read at some point.
Well, if I ever find another one.
Gotcha.
I can sell you mine for $23. No.
There you go. Kidding. Make yourself a tidy profit.
Well, not tidy. I mean, I got to mail it, you know. But
yeah. I'm just teasing.
Before you ask me any more questions or before we answer the listener questions that we've teased about earlier, I want you to answer a question and then I will pose another. So last episode, we were in the news last week in the This Week in Coin World History, This Week in Numismatic History, there was a reference to the gold nugget find. So I wanted to know last week, what was the world's largest gold nugget ever found? I think I said bonus points for when and where and size. Even if I didn't, I'm throwing you that now just as a wild card because you can roll with it.
Sure.
And there's a numismatic connection later, so I can explain that as well if you're not familiar with it.
Cool. So as far as weight of the largest gold nugget ever discovered, truthfully, I don't know. But I'm going to guess that it weighed in at, just to pick a round number, 30 pounds. And I'm going to guess that it was found, I want to say, either South Africa or Australia. Would I be anywhere close to right?
So you are correct in sussing out the location. Australia, for those who know, is home to the Victoria Goldfields. And they have a rich history. And that was actually where the story that I got to talk to the gents who found these two nuggets in recent times. And it is the home to the world's largest alluvial gold nuggets. This find came in 1869. You were off a little bit with your weight. You said like 30 pounds. It was actually 173 pounds.
Oh my God.
So that's more than 2,520 ounces. It returned once it was cleaned up and all that, 2,284 troy ounces. That's 156.6 pounds net. I did the math at $1,900 an ounce today. You're talking about a $4.339 million nugget. So a little more than $4.3 million US. The nugget is called Welcome Stranger. I've been wanting to look into why that name came about, but it's immaterial in this, except to say that when the Perth Mint decided to start bullion programs in the late 80s for gold, they decided to do a program honoring Australia's largest gold nuggets. And they show the Welcome Stranger on their bullion coin, their gold nugget bullion coin, and that classic design can still be found today. In fact, the story I wrote for the October Coin World, World Coin section about the Perth Mint annual bullion program mentions that the Welcome Stranger design is still being used for the 2021 bullion program for the gold. Yeah, so it's fun. You know, very few of us are going to be able to own the nugget. It's probably in a museum, I imagine, if it survived being melted. But you can buy the modern day iteration thereof anyway. So that was last week's question. This week, I wanted to know, if you listen with a keen ear, you might have sussed that I've been a little cagey. I haven't explained when exactly and where exactly the first wooden nickel usage occurred, because I wanted to ask Chris that as the question and really ask you, the listener. So we know that it's, Great Depression. That's a big hint, but I still want to know kind of a year or so time frame and where, and, you know, what was this item? Why was it? It set the trend. And there's actually a news this year that relates to this piece as well. So think about this in the next week until you listen to the next episode. Don't go to the Google, pick up your Coin World Almanac, pick up your, just think a little bit. See, if you do a little soul searching, you will find the answer. Perhaps we will have it next week when Chris will try his darndest, see if I have stumped him next week.
In the interim, just to give the listeners a little bit more to listen to while they're waiting with bated breath, I'm sure, for the answer to that, we had a few more questions from a listener, Justin Hutzley. We started answering his questions sometime in the last couple of weeks, but he had asked a number of interesting questions, and we wanted to come back and take care of the remainder of the question that we didn't answer. So, Jeff, what was he asking us about, and what do you make of his questions?
Thanks again to Justin for sending the questions. His third question, we've already dealt with the first question. His third question I want to address now, and then we can maybe, if we have time, go to the second. Sure. The question was, what do you foresee as the future of local coin shows? I went to my first coin show a couple of years ago and had a great time. I used to visit local coin shops to browse and discover new coins. With so much moving online, it is less likely for me to come across new coins of interest that are outside of existing items that I am already collecting. My impression is that local coin shops seem to be disappearing or focusing on buy-sell of precious metals. I wonder if shops are closing or going online due to COVID. So I want to tackle that first because I have visited a lot of shops in the last 3 weeks and I've tried to visit some shops. So
you are a far braver man than I will say. I have not, but
I go out with my mask. I figure there's limited interaction. I'm not going to be there hours. It's not like I'm an employee who's sitting there behind the table. So one of the things that over the weekend, I tried to go to a shop that I had just been at like 8 days prior, and they had to close. They weren't open that day unexpectedly. Their sister shop was, and I wasn't able to get down to the sister shop, but that's a good little shop. Again, I love just looking through the cheap stuff because that's what I can afford. You know, if you can pay a dime for something that's worth $2, you know, that's fun. You put it in a holder and you feel like you've caught this prey. It's the old hunter-gatherer instinct for a low cost. One of the shops in the Dayton area closed because they couldn't make it because of COVID. So that it's interesting he mentions that. I know that particularly there are some dealers that have switched to appointment-only business to limit traffic flow, both from a, you know, safety virus standpoint and also to a time standpoint, just that they're not having tire kickers come in and sit down and spend an hour of time with them and they sell a $15 item that they make a dollar on, which is a sad reality. But, you know, at the end of the day, this is a business. You got bills to pay, you got lights to keep on, and, you know, dealers can choose the level of their interest and participation. The show that I went to, the ICOTAM show, is always a small show. It was particularly small this recent iteration, but there was ample distancing between dealers and in the room. Most everyone had a mask. They had giant signs outside, you know, have your mask on, no entry without mask. And some of the dealers were wearing, all of them were wearing masks. Some of them weren't wearing them properly though. And, you know, it's just a reality that whatever your take on the situation, many local and state rules and laws require some of these things. And if we're going to participate in the hobby, whether we're happy about them or not, you know, this is the way we do it, is to follow those rules so that everybody can go in there and, you know, be able to still engage in the hobby. The folks that really need to engage in this for their business, for their lifestyle, you know, that they can do that. And I know there was a show in Dalton, Georgia a couple months ago that was just gangbusters, according to dealer reports. The Pan Pennsylvania Area Numismatist show is this coming weekend. The following weekend is the Coin X in St. Louis, Coin Expo. I may go for that since that's home and any chance to go look at coins. I'm feeling a little more brave as things, you know, I understand we're back on the upswing and whatnot, but with the temperature taking at some shows, with the requirement that people wear masks, it feels okay. There's still a risk. There's still an element of risk, but, you know, this is a way that I can engage in this. I mean, I picked up some stuff about which we can write and have stories and talk about. So, I mean, you know, this is a means to an end in as much as, you know, being able to do the job. But it's undeniable that shops have been under duress for a long time. Bullion is what keeps a lot of these shops open. Some shops did close, unfortunately, because of the pandemic. I think once we're through this, you know, 6, 8 months, 10 months, a year from now, for all the things that we lament, you know, the restaurants that have closed and other things, the real pain, it's undeniable. On the other side of that are going to be people who decide to take the risk and open a new restaurant that, you know, in this old space, or open a coin shop in this old space. And, you know, whatever the case may be, there will be a lot of this that comes back. You know, some behavior has changed, you know, working from home is more allowed and all that. But, you know, we crave the familiarity and the constancy. And I think we're going to get back to a lot of it. Of course, eBay is out there, and but it's been problematic for dealers with some of the changes that it's made there. That's why you see, I think, there's such a demand for Facebook groups. And I know that, you know, there may be some things changing in that regard with potential charges to sellers on Facebook beginning in the new year. I honestly don't know how, you know, I've just heard rumors around this. I don't know that that's factual. I don't, you know, but for now, it's a great place to be in a bunch of groups and see what's selling, communicate with fellow collectors. But I love the shop aspect, the hunt aspect, the show aspect, getting to see old friends and make new friends. And I can't imagine a world where those won't exist. I think in the interim, it's all these smaller shows that are thriving because they can move to a larger venue to accommodate the spacing. They have the agility and the workload isn't so tremendous to change the way they're doing things, and that still allow the shows to go on. Now, the A&A, I think they don't have as many options because when you have 800 dealers or whatever it is, you know, you're filling that room out to use the halls that they already use to expand that is going to jack up the price. There's going to be more costs that need to be borne and spread out. There are some dealers who are definitely reevaluating their show strategy. There are others who, you know, have certainly had to pivot and sell stuff online that they've not done before. But I think certainly among the folks who've been doing this for 20 plus years, shows, as long as they exist, they're going to be supporting the shows because of what they represent. And gosh, I sure hope so, because I love a good show, just like you, Chris. What do you think?
I think you've covered the resurgence of local shows really well. And I've definitely seen a lot of that. I've been hearing about not so much a couple of local shows in New England I know have remained canceled. And, you know, just for myself personally, I'm a little leery of going to a show, at least until the pandemic has subsided a little bit more.
Well, certainly not when you're in another wave. I mean, although, right, you know, thankfully New England is not, has been, you know, touched.
Yeah,
by
the
recently,
numbers but. are ticking up on the North Shore a little bit faster than they are across the state as a whole. Okay. But generally speaking, Massachusetts and New England have, at least for the past couple of months, few months, been spared some of the worst. I know that, you know, there are areas of the country like Wisconsin that are really being hit hard right now. And obviously our thoughts go out to any of our listeners in areas that are being really severely afflicted by COVID. Not that the affliction is not severe anywhere else. But to your point, I think that local shows also offer dealers an ability to kind of dip their toes back into the pool of going to shows. And especially in areas where certain dealers operate, you know, major dealers will sometimes go to smaller shows. And that can be a good way to keep networks of buyers and sellers active. And to the extent that that's continuing to happen, that's good. And obviously, we're concerned about the demise of small businesses of all kinds across the country. But coin shops, Jeff, as you mentioned, are being hit pretty hard by this. I was struck by something that Justin said, or at least I was surprised by something that he said. He said that with so much moving online, it is less likely for me to come across new coins of interest that are outside of existing item that he's already collecting. I was struck by that because at least, I mean, eBay has an astounding array of things. But, you know, online, like social media coin auction groups, for example, have a massive range of material. And you can join groups that are as generalized or as specialized as you want. And I think that it's possible when shopping for coins online to find a massive variety of things. In fact, larger than many shops or individual dealers might actually have. Now, don't get me wrong. I love going into a coin shop or going to a coin show and just browsing through a dealer's inventory and seeing what jumps out at. For me, that's a lot of the joy of the hobby, kind of encapsulated in one experience. Valuable and enjoyable as that treasure hunting is, you know, you can have a similar experience just scrolling through online auctions. It's even edifying to look at big auctions. If major auction houses are selling off major collections, I mean, I think of the Bob Simpson collection, which, you know, sales of that started, I guess, a couple of months ago now. I was looking at some of the highlighted lots in that auction. And of course, those are pieces that I'll likely never own or, you know, and I'll never probably own material in the same class as that material. It's, you know, some of it is truly extraordinary.
Yeah, the Simpson collection is head of the class, and you and I are class clown, so.
Yeah, that might even be a generous description of us. But, you know, just reading the listings and scrolling through the auction offerings is actually a really great way to learn things. I mean, I knew, like, there were pieces in there that I honestly didn't know existed, or if I knew that they existed, I didn't know much of their backstory. And, you know, the auction houses pour significant resources into online catalogs and into paper catalogs. At some point on the show, Jeff, you and I will have to talk about, you know, notable auction catalogs and how they can sort of function as reference works in their own right. But I think that online coin shopping, you know, you can find a massive range of material. And so I would encourage Justin and anyone else who is kind of having to engage in the hobby at a distance or do it virtually, you know, to seek out, you know, auctions large and small, and seek out social media groups, not only just about coins. I mean, it's lovely to have a social space to interact with other collectors and build a network. But I would also encourage people to look at auction sites large and small, auctions large and small, to expose themselves to as much as possible and to take the time to, you know, either read hobby literature, subscribe to a new periodical. Coin World would be a great one. Collectors can take this moment to kind of
pause.
To kind of
the
take a pause
that refreshes. I look at 2020 as sort of my intermission. You know, I just turned 41 this year. So this year, you know, come March 6th or so, life just kind of went on hold, and that's okay. I'm focusing on getting organized and just really taking this pause to just rest, reflect, and get ready for the second act of my life. It's also notable, depending on where Justin is, we never ask for a location. You know, I went to a flea market a couple weeks ago, and certainly further south, the weather will be great all the time for this. But I love one of our local flea markets. I always come away with some numismatic stuff. Well, I went to a new one this time 3 weeks ago, and I found a really cool metal from 1964 that I've really been unable to find much information on it. It's a modern piece struck, I believe, by Medallic Art Company. It's in a holder that has room for another metal. The holder only has the bronze metal with it. I suspect the other metal was a silver version. The seller didn't seem to know. He probably bought it out of an auction or estate. You know, who knows where the original owner of this was and what happened. I would love to know more, and I'll probably write about it at some point. But it was a fun little day and diversion to go to this flea market and to find this really neat metal. And I go to flea markets and find all sorts of world coins and metals, wooden nickels. I even got an elongated cent at this same flea market that was done by Ray Dillard, a guy that I interviewed back at the Fun Show, again, what seems like 5 years ago, but was just in January. And we posted that as a podcast episode, one of the, you know, that I went down to Fun and had fun there and all that. So there certainly are plenty of ways to find the hobby, like the antique stores to which, you know, we referenced earlier. You know, the good thing, flea markets, they're outside and certainly in warmer weather and climates, then, you know, I didn't feel like it was much of a risk to be outside. You know, the wind's dispersing everything, and many people had masks, and myself included. So, you know, there are ways to still stay engaged and involved. Do your local shop a favor, not only patronize them, but give them good social media reviews, Facebook, Yelp, whatever. That will help them. And if you've had some less than positive interactions, give them a chance to make it up before you go bomb them. But certainly many folks, many shops that care about their reputation, they work hard because of that. That's why it's supporting them when it makes sense, when, you know, and many folks are, many shops are fair and all that. Support the good ones. Don't support the other ones. That will help the good ones stick around.
Yeah, absolutely. Patronize as many local coin shops as you can. They could use the support, and patronize small businesses in general. They could also use the support, but definitely patronize coin shows in your area. And once shows start opening up, I know that I'm hoping to start setting up at shows and, you know, selling a few items out of my collection with a few numismatic friends I have here in Massachusetts. So it's going to be wonderful once shows really start up in earnest, especially the national shows, which I can speak from experience as someone who hasn't operated in the hobby professionally for a long time. Attending large national shows, if you can, especially if a large national show is in your area. You know, if you live in Chicago, large shows happen there pretty frequently, including the ANA show has been in Chicago many, many times. And those shows are wonderful learning experiences. So I'm really looking forward to shows coming back so that I can attend the educational seminars that they have, so that I can, you know, talk to dealers out on the bourse and try to encounter new material, just like Justin's trying to do, that online. But, you know, there's really no learning experience quite like a large national show. So we're looking forward to those coming back. And local coin shows are really important, too, not only for supporting the health of local numismatic organizations, but, you know, you can learn a lot in those environments as well. So
and meet fellow collectors. So please do support them. We're going to end today. We'll get to the other question in the future. And by all means, send us your questions.
Yes,
we want to talk about this stuff. Some of this is it's a learning experience for both of us sometimes, as much as you who's listening. Some of it is just, oh, yeah, it reminds me of something that I learned, when I was newer in the hobby, whatever. But send that to us so we can we want to be of service and have something fun to talk about.
We make this show for all of you, and we make this show to be useful for all of you. So if we can be a sounding board for ideas, or if we can answer your questions, we would be more than happy to do that. And we really hope that you enjoyed our answers to Justin's questions and our discussion of wooden nickels prompted by Southern Coin. So again, we really hope that you enjoyed it, and we hope that you keep on listening every week, and please remember to subscribe on whatever platform you get your podcasts.
And until next time, happy collecting.
Thank you for listening to the Coin World Podcast. Don't forget to subscribe, and we'll see you next week. Send us your questions and feedback on Facebook at facebook.com/coinworld or on Twitter @coinworld. Be the first to know about our next episode by signing up for our newsletter. Go to coinworld.com and click on free newsletter to sign up today.
Thanks for the segue, big voice guy. This is Brian again, reminding you to sign up for the CoinWorld email newsletters. It's free and easy to do. Just click on the link I put in the show notes, choose your topics, and the high-quality content you expect from CoinWorld will be on its way shortly. So click on that link to sign up, and thanks for listening to the show.